because you're jumping back into the gap. I let the coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Leads the country in offensive rebounding.
Hey, coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver, the founder, CEO, and creative mind behind BasketballImmersion.com. This is the podcast where you will hear real basketball coaching conversations. Whether you are a new or experienced coach at any level of basketball, these coaching conversations will give you practical ideas to stimulate your coaching and make what you do even better. Without any more delay, let's share the game. Welcome today, Coach Steve Donahue. Coach Donahue, in his stints at Cornell, BC, and Penn, has been tremendously successful as a head coach, and I think one of those coaches that other coaches love to learn from. And great to have you on board, Coach, today. And you're the only coach to take two different teams in the Ivy League history to the conference championship. Do I have that correct?
You do, Chris. Thank you.
That's a tremendous stat and tremendous achievement. And again, thanks for joining us, Coach.
Well, it's nice of you. That introduction means a lot. I never heard it that way. And if guys are anxious to learn from me, that means a great deal to me, because I look for guys to learn from more than anybody else. So if I can help others, I'm grateful that you said that. Thanks.
Well, I know we're going to get into a lot of fun stuff here today. And Coach, let's start with a quote that I've heard you say, and which is something that is right in my wheelhouse, which relates to decision-making. And it's that you don't need to be athletic to play fast. You need players who can make decisions quickly. Still believe in that, Coach?
I do, Chris. I think in particular, this time of year when we're recruiting, we have a tendency to look at it like it's a horse race, and we're looking at the horse and check the legs and just how fast they run and how they look and the length. And you get enamored with that stuff in July, and in February you're kicking yourself because you didn't value the things that you really value to win games. And that's the ability to make decisions quickly while playing fast. I think all of us love to play fast. I know there's some outliers, but my feeling is always I want kids that play fast for a lot of reasons. But the hard thing is really is finding kids that can do that and make the right decisions. And that's a difficult thing to teach once they're in your program if they show no ability to do that at the time.
Coach, saying that then, as kind of a statement, I guess, generally for coaches that work with the level of players that you recruit, how do you think that we're missing the boat a little bit on developing decision-making at the high school level? Or more importantly, how do you evaluate a player? Because obviously we know in the AAU system and everything, it's got to be extremely hard to evaluate whether someone's a good decision-maker.
It is extremely hard. And I think, that's the art of all this. As much as I'm as guilty as anybody with the analytics, the situation really that the kids are put in is so varied in recruiting that it's difficult to figure out exactly how they're going to make this transition and who can make decisions. But you look for certain things. Like, I'll give you an example. We're recruiting a kid this year, and he's on a team with two talented guards. However, they're not good decision makers. And I've fallen really for this kid, and I want to coach him because he's learned how to make this situation work by sometimes deferring to these kids and allowing them to do the things they do that can sometimes be crazy, but help the team win. He's not getting frustrated. He's not doing all those things. And then when he has the opportunity to really exhibit how he wants the team to win, he does all the right things, and he makes his teammates better. That's kind of how we go about it, trying to look at it. Each of these situations different, but in our world with the different level of talent, unlike the NBA, which is essentially the same level, we've got so many varying degrees in the recruiting process. We just have to make sure we're putting that on the forefront.
Is that something that's easier to evaluate in practice or in a training session than it is in a game even? Or do you feel like all three areas can help you in terms of evaluating someone's decision making?
Yeah, I think you got to look at it in various ways. I think if you get caught up in a frame situation like a drills and a broken down, I mean, I have kids that I believe would do fine in those situations. The difficult part of basketball is, and I say it this way, I can coach hard skills. Hard skills are footwork, positioning, how to use your body, how to pass with both hands, how to dribble with your head up. They're hard skills. The difficult ones are the soft skills. These are the ones that are very difficult to teach once you get them because the game changes so much. So you could say, oh, you know what, here's where you need to be, but literally less than a second later, he better have moved. He better have done something differently in a split second. And those soft skills are hard to break or even hard to improve vastly if they showed no ability to do that initially. So if they show signs of it, great. But to get kids to change dramatically with those soft skills, by the time we get them, I think it's really hard.
No, it's a great challenge. And for coaches that are listening, basically a soft skill is the application of the hard skill. It's the game application of in certain terms of applying a decision and doing some things like that. And as you can imagine, the complexity goes up with the level too, which is the other challenge. And the complexity that you're dealing with at your level is players have to be able to play, execute their skills, but execute it in that open environment where you don't know what the defense is doing, and incredibly complex.
That's a good way of putting it. I think in the same vein, if you see, and we get back to playing fast, like that's has very little to do with athleticism. Now, there's got to be a baseline for every level we're at, and it goes up, obviously, with each level. But the kid that exhibits that at a young age, his ability, his feel, his understanding of where he needs to be, where his teammates need to be, his verbal, nonverbal communication, if that shows at a young age, that could really grow and make him a great player. And we had a kid in our league, Spencer Weiss from Princeton, last year was our league MVP. And he was not recruited very heavily out of high school. Average athlete, if not below average. Not a great shooter. I don't even think he averaged double figures when he won the MVP. But the things that he did that made his team win were remarkable. And I don't think people realize that Spencer Weiss, when they were recruiting him, what he would do at the college level.
No, and that's a great point that some of those things that don't always connect when you're evaluating someone connect at the next level. And I sometimes equate it to the fact that they're playing with better players. So because sometimes they're playing with better players, players become better. And especially, I think, for size, a lot of size plays better with better guards, obviously. So that type of connection as well.
No doubt. There's so many variables that go into the evaluation process. And we try to do it in different ways. We have a 10-point evaluation. And I would say six of them are your hard skills and four are intangibles. And then we all try to look at them and then we look at the number. We've done it over the years, so I can go back and look at what that number equates to in terms of future success. But even that, everything keeps changing in this world, and every situation's different. You just have to have it. And I think there's certain guys in this business that I admire greatly. John Beilein, just an incredible ability to see what translates to his program based on what he's watching. That's a remarkable skill.
Tremendous skill. Coach, the other thing that I've heard you say is that, which I value tremendously, is to not talk or not over talk about turnovers with your players. And a certain amount of that for me equates to giving a player a freedom to be who they are and to make the right decision that they feel at the time rather than the decision that we dictate for them. And is that the basis of not talking about turnovers?
It is. And that alone starts the huge conversation of your philosophy as a coach in a lot of ways. I'm just watching a documentary called In Search of Greatness. Now, it's not out there. I'm actually helping the producer of the movie. But they talk about youth sports, and they followed Pele, Gretzky, and Jerry Rice. And all three of them, because I know you do youth, all three of them talked about the ability of their young coach when they were kids, whether parents or coaches with them, allowed them to express themselves and have freedom to do, even if it wasn't as structured as maybe coaches want it to be. And all three of them essentially said that was a key aspect of their growth, in that we didn't harp on the mistakes or do it this way or it's wrong. Let the kid tell you. Maybe there's something that you'll learn based on that. But with my philosophy with turnovers, it's all based on how are we going to get better. And I think if you continually grade yourself on how well we didn't turn it over, you're really missing the big picture. For us to improve, I want guys to try things. I want guys to attempt it. Now, we're always going to go back and evaluate mistakes, and I may let them pass in practice. Maybe get them individually and say and show them on film what the mistake was, but I'm really hesitant to jump on a mistake if I feel that they did it trying to make a great play. So essentially, I say this a lot. I always think the team that wins the majority of the time is the team that's willing to make mistakes. If you're willing to really know what that's going to be like if it goes wrong and you can handle all that, then I think we got a chance to be really good. And not just today, but 3 months from now. So even if my teams in the past have been, you know, I think we're on the probably the top 100, maybe top 50 in turnovers, not top 10. And I think our assisted turnovers is in the top 25. I'd rather make 20 really great plays and 10 bad ones than make 10 good great plays and only 8 bad ones. I just think for the short run and the long run, it's just not going to help our growth if we continually harp on what they're doing wrong and criticize the turnovers.
Well, you're speaking my language and my philosophy, and coaches far too often don't connect creativity with freedom, and creativity comes from freedom and those opportunities in practice for self-discovery and finding things that they don't know they can do yet unless you give them the freedom to do it. And coach, I love that documentary. Can't wait to watch it. And this is a great segue back to a topic that I know is something that I believe you reflect in your coaching, and that's positive coaching. This concept of you don't have to coach a certain way. You don't have to coach the way the media portrays a coach, which is far off too often, probably the, not doing justice to the coaching profession. But can you talk a little bit about what positive coaching is and some of the practical things that you think are positive coaching that all coaches can apply?
Sure. Just to give you a background, my background, I play for an old school coach who I love dearly, and ironically and sadly, he passed yesterday. And he's
sorry
a legendary
to hear that, coach.
Yeah, a legendary coach named Bud Gardler. And he was really, if there's one person that maybe want to be a coach, and he didn't tell me this, I watched him and admired him and all the influence he had on me as a young person wanted me to really go after that profession. But I also learned through the years some of the things I would do differently if I was coaching me. And I kind of try to handle that as a coach. And fast forward to my stint at Cornell, we struggled. I go 10 years at Penn as an assistant. We win 6 out of the last 8 championships, coach 3 NBA players. Think I have all the answers. And first 6 years, do not have a winning record. And as I did that, I didn't really evaluate what we're talking about now. How was I coaching? What were the words I was using? We had a pretty tragic event at the time. A young man named Khalid Gant broke his neck on a late Monday night practice. He ended up walking again, never playing basketball. That was a defining moment in my eyes of how I was coaching. Not that I felt I caused that, but I believe that was God's way, or whatever we believe in, that I need to change. I need to address issues, challenges differently. And from that point on, I think I learned how to use coaching and develop my craft in a much better way.
So that incident brought some perspective to you.
It did.
And then with that, coach, like, how did you, because look, I struggled with this as a young coach, that I coached the way I was coached. I didn't like how I was coaching because I was coaching in a reflection of myself that I didn't feel was myself. So how does a coach actually evaluate themselves to follow through on this change, even without such an event that brings perspective? Because there's still that process you have to go through of doing that, doing the work for yourself. What were some of the things that helped you do the work?
Well, I think I read a lot and I learn a lot, and I'm hoping I continue to evolve. And that's essentially what this world, you have to do in every profession. And I try to tell it to all young coaches when I watch them and watch the language they use. And I just think it's critical that you really evaluate yourself as you're coaching your team in terms of how you're developing your craft. So allowing yourself to be vulnerable and not always be right is a great way to allow yourself to coach your kids the right way. If you're willing to be wrong, I just think it opens your mind as you watch your kids play and you have a different perspective of what they're going through. Essentially, my year off, after my 4 years at Boston College, I had a year off, and I went to probably almost 50 different practices, whether it's college, high school, NBA. I went over to Europe, and I just kind of evaluated coaches. And some of them I tried to help, but one thing I just picked up to myself was I listened to the words the guys used to a coach used to a player. And I'm listening, and I know what the coach is trying to say is correct. It needed to be said, but the message was lost because the language he picked. And then I watched the player's reaction to it, and he did not get it because of the words that were picked. And I would go back to the coach after practice. I'd just say, you know what? Not that this means much, but you know how many times you cursed today? And typically they would giggle or laugh and just say, maybe five times. And typically it was in the 30 to 50 range. And that surprised them. And my point is, I don't judge people on their language. I'm judging them on how to help them be a better coach. And this was hurting them, let alone what we're trying to all do and why do we coach, and the purpose behind it is to help these young people better themselves. And that was getting lost as well. So I just try to, the way you say something and the words you choose are important. And I go back to that. If you're willing to admit you're wrong and vulnerable to your group, that's going to allow your group to build trust in what you're saying as well.
Well, that's excellent practical advice there, coach. And it's amazing. Just removing your ego from the coaching equation is so difficult because clearly we're the ones that more than our players on public display and being evaluated fairly or unfairly. So that's such a challenging process. So, and it involves work. And that's, I'm glad you gave some practical things for coaches to follow through. And I don't know, coach, have you recorded yourself in practice before? Recorded your audio?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I encourage all coaches to do that. There's nothing more impactful than that.
That's a great point, Chris. I think it is. I mean, I think you'll be surprised. And I try to, you know, listen, a lot of things we talk about in my program are nonverbal communication and body language and the message you're sending. Well, there's times I watch games and I don't like how I look. And I do my best to improve on that for a lot of reasons. But essentially, you know, I don't want my players to see me act a certain way. Everything I'm teaching goes out the window. It's very hypocritical to me if, as a coach, you can't teach what you preach. So that's important to me as well. And I think it's a great point that you can evaluate yourself, the words and how you look in practice and all those things that can make you better at your craft.
No, that's great. And then you brought up the other part, which is record yourself in the game too. And whether it's you self-evaluating or as in your example where you traveled and watched people's practice and helped them with a peer evaluation, those things are so valuable. So valuable improvement. So
it's fun to do as well. You'll be amazed how, like, I thought I was going to go see some really consistent things across the board. But, like, I'll give you a great example because I think it'll resonate with people. In a 24-hour period, I saw Tony Bennett's practice and Shaka Smart's practice. And think about the difference in the style of play and what people look at it. But you, to this extent, the things that were common with them were the reason they're both great. They both had incredible trust in their players, and the love that each had for each other and the coach was apparent. So how did they get to that point? I'm only taking a snapshot. But the things I said, I think, and I'm good friends with both those guys, and I'm just observing them, but their ability to not have all the answers to, like, the things you talked about, Chris, allowing kids freedom, the willingness to accept a player for what he is and then learn how to make him grow in both those programs. That was apparent. Now, the intensity and the noise and the way each went about it was dramatically different, but those critical pieces of relationships that they had with their players was almost identical.
Well, that is a great connection, Coach. That's so good. I mean, in theory, look at two different coaches that styles may contrast more than any others. And that's great, that commonality that exists. So, Coach, I got to ask, dribble pass ratio, getting into some X's and O's and
yeah, sure,
some of your offensive stuff. But that's something you guys emphasize within your program.
So we're lucky we have some Wharton students that have a group of about 30 kids, believe it or not, that are really into the analytics. So they asked me for things I would like to know during a practice. And that's one of the ones I done on my own. I can remember at Cornell, you know, having a piece of paper and charting each possession back in the VHS days even. And seeing how many times we dribbled and how many times we passed. And the last piece was, how many times we made a basket cut? A basket cut meaning how many times did we literally put pressure on a basket with a great cut and then re-space? So the pass ratio one was, I realized when we were getting close to 1-to-1, we were not as efficient if we could get 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 5-to-1 pass to dribble. Now, I think everyone has to base it on your personnel and where you're at. But my teams in general are not built to over dribble. So I know for this is important for my group. Now, I won't say it's like everything else. I think it's a piece of the evaluation. But I know when we're playing good offense, I can go back and like, wow, look at this one. In this possession, 4 basket cuts, 8 passes, 2 dribbles, layup. Open 3. So I know it's a product of what the final result will be.
And that speaks to how so much of this is team specific and philosophy specific. And I've had other coaches, Nate Oates being one of them on here, that talked about one of his fears was that with too many passes, they're more likely to turn it over or more likely not to create an advantage off the dribble. But again, a team that's set up to play a completely different style than what yours is, and neither's right, neither's wrong. It's what works for what you guys do. And clearly you've shown that this is something that works for you guys as well. So go ahead.
Yeah, and I think it goes into my philosophy, and then there's other guys like St. Mary's, and I've seen Coach Bennett talk, and I love watching them play. They're dramatically different in some ways, and one of the ways is they just don't pass it that much because he doesn't want to turn it over. So we go back to our original point with you is, for us to be great, I think we got to turn it over and continually grow. I just don't want to go backwards. But that's how I believe I can do it at the University of Pennsylvania.
And, Coach, you mentioned basket cuts. And This is something when I visualize your team, some of the actions and some of the different things, there's tremendous emphasis on hard cutting. And when I notice the progression of the game as well, since it's so ball screen heavy at so many levels, off the ball cuts, the weak side 45 cuts, different types of cutting actions are becoming more evident in the game as well. But one of the challenges is, how do you get players, one, to make the decision to cut, and two, to cut hard, as you said before, as a scoring cut, to cut to score, not to just cut? No what are question. Some things that you guys do?
There's some technical things, Chris, but I'll give you a little bit of a background. I was very fortunate to coach against Pete Carril.
Of course, yes.
For a long time. So, and the Princeton stuff when they really ran it. So in this league, Penn and Princeton back then, you had to beat them or you weren't going to win a championship. So I really dove into it my first 10 years here and learned a lot how he taught it by watching so much. So I think there's probably three different ways to teach it that we do, and it's based on how the defense plays you. So essentially, I'm going to try to do this verbally, but if someone's in you, then you allow them to get in you to a point, and then we use a swim move where we get them moving one way, and we literally use our inside hand, push them out of the way, and cut. And everything's the same. That hand closest to the basket when you cut has to be up. So the critical piece to this is the passer knows if that defender turns his back and guards it like most teams do, and you can get the pass off, you should throw it. And I think that's the concept in itself, is when you should cut, when you should throw it. It's basically, it's on the guy who has the ball job to realize what is happening, not the guy who's going to cut. Some people say, oh, wait, you cut too early. Well, if the guy has the ball, you got to be good enough to realize that that guy in your next window of action is being guarded the way he is, and he's going to cut. Now, we break this down probably every practice, 4-0, and we go over all of our different concepts that we use. We don't have a lot of sets, so everything's a read and react, but there's probably a collection of 40 different concepts that we gave names to. So we yell them out. So we're teaching the move, the verbal reminder, and all that goes into that 4-0. If the guy's off you, we teach running in place, let the defender get anxious, and then take him one way and then go the other again. So, and we got names for all of it. But like anything else, Chris, I think it's, if it's something you really believe in, you got to figure out how it's going to fit within your offense, and then you got to dedicate time to it and then continue to grow your knowledge of where you want it to happen for your team.
Coach, it leads into a bunch of questions, and this is outstanding stuff. Thank you. Don't worry about getting too technical here. That's the whole point of this, to be honest, is that
right.
I'm not a media member. We can have this basketball conversation. Yep. So the cue for the passer, that's so important. And I'm glad you highlighted that, because it's almost more important, the passer's decision, than the cutter's decision. And
it is.
And you said, so someone gets into you, you swim cut. Someone's off of you, you run in place to set up your cut to try and make them feel anxious. Yep. And I think you said there was a third one.
Yeah, the third one is he's just overplaying.
Right.
So we're just going to really give him a quick one direction jab and go. So there's three different techniques. Don't overthink this.
Right.
Read it and react. But there are the three different ones that we will work on. The technique of it, I think, is important with cutting. Because I've been around coaches and I watch their practice and they say, oh, cut really hard. And they cut really hard. And they show the hand and he says, run through the whole cut and then go out. Well, there is that piece. But there's also a sense of what's going on in the game. Sometimes I want that guy to cut and shorten the cut and just get out any way he can. So I don't want to be mechanical about your cuts. And that's where the feel for this is, you get it. And you got to get, you may go out the same side. Essentially, you go off the other side, but that's not necessarily true. The point about catching, I think, is critical. Because once again, I think, and I've listened to your podcast when you're young, my coach, and when I was coaching, like, catch, square up, triple threat. Well, the game's going too fast.
Yeah.
And this is another Pete Carril. Guess what he didn't teach? He didn't teach V-cut, and he really didn't teach triple threat. So, and I know you talked about this too, being catch ready to shoot the ball. Well, if you're going to be open, you should be ready to shoot the ball, not triple threat. So catch it, ready to shoot it is probably the deferred way and the default that you should be able to do that every time you catch it without having to, and this is where evaluating, does the game go too fast for kids? Can you catch it and understand before you get it a Spurs in 0.5 seconds? 0.5 seconds to make the decision. Now, the decision may be, I'm not passing it. But the decision may be, shoot it, pass it, swing it, extra. All those things are based on your ability to catch and know what's happening as the game's going on.
I love the way you frame that, Coach, because, again, like, you're essentially, you already made the decision before you catch the ball.
Yep.
Perception happens, then decision, then execution. So that's great. But, Coach, you said a few things I want to circle back to. And the first one is, I connect back to what you said previously about your philosophy about turnovers, is one of the reasons players don't cut hard is because they never get the ball.
Yeah.
And if they never get the ball, they're not going to continue to cut hard. It's like the big that we want to rim run and we're frustrated they don't rim run. Well, if we never pass on the ball, they're not going to rim run hard. And that comes back to that freedom of being willing to turn it over a few times to get better at throwing the passes that are necessary. And I imagine that's a big part of your offense and the Princeton offense, is there's got to be some bravery to throw some of those passes initially to get comfortable.
No doubt. And I think a lot of coaches give up on the cutting because they think it's more of a waste. And now listen, and this is, sounds crazy, but the more you cut, more critical respacing is. Like, we all like to space now, ball screen action, but if you cut, then spacing is critical. When I grew up, the motion offense, Bobby Knight, was the thing, and I loved it. But I also got frustrated with it because I would make a great cut, and then somebody else would be cutting, and the spacing wouldn't be good, in particular now at the three-point line. So I think guys get frustrated teaching cutting. What I would say to you is, let's encourage those kids, in particular bigs now, to make those passes. And don't worry if they throw it into the third row or they bounce it off the defender's knee. But I'm the belief that I'm almost scared if I don't get a lot of basket cuts, because in my mind, my visual focus on how I think we're going to win on offense is based on how well we cut, because I don't know if we go east and west how we're going to score. And that's a critical piece to it. So, and even this year, we had our 4 and 5 men were second and third in assists, one at 82, one at 78. Now, they both had almost as many turnovers, but it made us a very good offensive team, because teams really had to guard the cutting. And in today's game, I just think everything's going to evolve again. I know ball screen, and it's a big piece, but if you notice, the defenses are starting to play ball screen. So we're end up going one-on-one. Evolve it again. I thought Golden State, and this came in my mind, the first game of that series, they played strictly ball screen, allowed Cleveland to do their rotations and switch it. The next game, they started cutting, slipping, switching, and I thought it changed the whole series.
No, that's a great point. And for me, Coach, I mean, you said so many really important things to come back to there, but I imagine for your team, the other benefit of cutting is that you do shoot a lot of threes and you don't have a lot of isolation dribble drive guys. So to balance out the threes, it's the cutting, right? The cut to score and playing through the post if you have a post matchup. So I think that's important for coaches to understand.
No, the critical point, Chris. I think, guys, how do you get open threes? And I've talked about my philosophy enough, what I'm trying to do. We're trying to get a layup or a dunk or get fouled doing it. That's the critical piece that I think is slightly different. We have what we call a 95% rule. when a guy drives to the rim, I want them for 95% certainty that they're going to get scored or get fouled. If they don't, we have mechanisms in place to allow them to attack the rim and then still not give up and give in a bad possession. So the 95% will be based on keep your dribble. We have other things we call. There's going to be a guy in the opposite corner. There's going to be a guy in the direct corner. There's going to be someone filmed from behind. There's going to be a big going to the arc, the old dotted line. Second one is a standstill three. The third one is an offensive rebound to allow, same thing, layup or dunk or standstill three. And essentially on defense, we do the same three things. No layup or dunk, and critical that you don't foul doing it. No in-rhythm threes, and limit teams to one shot. So everything we do is kind of based on those three things year-round. So back to your point about cutting. So how do you get standstill threes? A lot of it is you have to get two-on-one. So most people say, let's get someone. That's why we drive it, which is good. So we can get somebody to help and get them in rotation. But if you consistently cut hard, that guy who's in the hole will have to react. Someone's going to have to rotate to him. We're going to get a lot of things we want without having to put the ball on the floor.
No, that's great. And all I was going to do is make the connection for youth coaches about what you said about the mechanism when a player gets close to the rim, because that's so important. That's one of the critical things that I talk about to any youth coach, high school or whatever, is do you teach your players what to do when they get deep, but they don't have a shot opportunity, they don't have a score opportunity, or they go dead, right? Because playing off the dead for youth basketball is so important, because you know players are going to dribble into trouble. So how do they get out of that situation, or how do you attack out of that situation?
I think you're right on, Chris. I think that's the biggest issue I have with bad AAU ball. Now, there's good AAU ball, but the majority of it comes with kids trying to attack the rim and really don't understand what decision needs to be made. And how, as you said, can we give these guys some tools if you get caught in this? And then work on them. And I give you one that we do quite a bit, and Villanova was great at it. We teach it differently, but essentially, when you get stuck and you're too deep, your ability to pivot back, and then that guy is looking to cut, not just kind of kick it back to me at a half court. That's a great opportunity, because the defenses have a tendency to start jumping towards the cutter, and it's a great lane to cut to the rim. If we could just teach those kind of things when guys get caught in those tough moments attacking the rim, I think that you'll find out that these kids are much more prepared. I think they'll be much more comfortable playing the game in an aggressive way.
I'm glad you brought up Villanova, because I was going to mention that too, because they've obviously been one of those most obvious examples of this. And I've written two blogs. One's called The Second Cut, and the other one's The Back Pivot. And that's what I call the terms that they use. They cut off the drive, and then they back pivot and use what we would call patient pivots to find advantage. And as I said, they're really, really good at it. And that's
great. You know what? Villanova's great for a lot of reasons. They're great because those kids will all believe in it. Like, it's every single one of them. I always say they play like they're not that talented, yet they're, you have four NBA guys right now on the last year's team. They play and they give up themselves, and it's a credit to the culture, and go back to all the things we talk about of working on your craft. Jay Wright continues to grow as a coach over the last 20 years that enables his players to develop the way they have.
Everyone's going to steal that quote, Coach. Play like they're not that talented. And we all want our players to embody that, don't we?
Yeah.
That's great. Something else to come back to, which I thought was extremely important that you said for coaches to understand, is because I think there's this tradition of pass and cut offense where the cutter always goes to the rim and then empties out to the weak side. And you said shorten your cuts. And I can say without a doubt that this is such a huge difference, because especially if you're talking about being able to drive into double gaps, because that deep cut and empty to the weak side usually almost always takes away a double gap opportunity. And I thought that was so important for coaches to understand that it's okay to shallow cut it, shorten cut it, whatever you call it. And it creates a better advantage in some ways than the deep cut too.
There's a lot of things I've taken from coaches that I really like. And Fran O'Hanlon's a wizard on offense. My issue with some of this is, and I think I learned my lesson with my stay at Boston College. Two out of my 4 years were number one efficient offense in that league. Yet I didn't last more than 4 years because down the other end, we didn't guard. And part of this is how this all fits on both ends. I think if it was just offense and you want to cut and wear your guys down and not have anything to give on the other end, then you could really work on different things. But there's got to be a give and take a little bit, in particular with the cutting. However, I think teaching ways to cut and still maintain a poise and a cardiovascular degree of success so you're not worn out to play defense is important as well. And I think as a coach, it's important that you find that balance somehow. And I think one way, as I said, I just saw coaches, we cut, and they screaming and doing these really hard cuts, and it's taking so much energy. And meanwhile, the read was, as you said, probably just a little shallow cut and respace.
Great connection between your offense and your defense to understand that too. Coach, adapting your offense from the Ivy League to the ACC back to the Ivy League, what things have adapted for you, or did that change much from the different places that you've been based on not just your personnel, but more against who your opponents are? And I say that particularly with interest about the ACC. If you're playing against bigger, longer, more athletic, those players, if you run multiple actions, those players have more time to disrupt those actions. Is that fair to say that in that certain levels that maybe you have to adapt based on the personnel you're playing, or is it just a different way of teaching or emphasizing certain things you've already done?
All right. So let's look at it this way. I think there's a discipline at this lower level that makes it really hard to run good offense. And you have to be very disciplined and dedicated to reversing the ball and cutting. They're just not going to give you. And hence, your personnel isn't necessarily going to get you an easy basket at times. So you have to understand that. Let's go back to the ACC. ACC, when I got there, we had a team that was picked 11th out of 12, and we won 21 games and finished fourth. And my first time coaching more of an elite athlete. And I loved the opportunity to coach Reggie Jackson, because Reggie taught me a ton that I didn't really realize. So I had these guys, for instance, my first 20 years of my coaching career, coaching Ivy League guys, guy cuts back door, catches it. He still has a lot of work left. He's got to figure out a way to get around the defense, and he doesn't have much lift. Well, the ACC guys, Reggie, Corey, Raji, Pico Parrish, well, they're finishing with dunks because they had that window. So there's a give and take with that. Now, the length at that level, you have to really be efficient as well. But my sense was that we were pretty different than everybody they were playing. So as much as the coaches prepared them, I got them to get upright. I got them to chase us. And I felt that we could get easier shots because it was a credit to the guys that I coached that they were willing to buy in to this offensively. We didn't do a great job guarding that length down the other end.
Right. Well, I can relate that, Coach, because I play against I know someone who's been you've been a mentor to, and Steph Berry at Queen's University here. And yeah. I mean, I can tell you without a doubt that that's one of the teams that our players don't like playing against because of how they cut and how they move. And they have a lot of similarities to what you guys do. And as you said, it's just completely different than what we play against normally. So there's a huge advantage to that for them in that sense, that that's not something we prepare for weekly.
Yeah. It was funny because I thought there was going to be a dramatic difference. But essentially, I don't think we're not we're playing essentially the way we play is the way the game is being played at the highest level in Europe and the NBA. I'm just adding things that I think can help my individual guys be more successful. I'm so against setting up, and I know you love to play fast, and I love to play fast and get the ball up, and for so many reasons. It's more fun for kids, and I think their engagement level's higher. They can explore their individuality, and 3 months later, we have a much better player because of just the way we play. That's the exciting part for me as a coach.
Well, that's great. The practice, the way you practice, and all those different things help your players develop every day. And coach, I mean, there's so many directions and I can go with this, but let's go to this one because I get asked this a lot from coaches and I'd love to hear your perspective is how do you watch film? Like, how do you watch film nowadays? And obviously you have some resources that maybe a high school coach doesn't have, but let's focus on just in terms of the basics beyond the resources. How do you watch film?
There's a lot of things, different ways, but let's just talk about, because it'll probably be relate to them better. And we film all of our practices and I watch all of our practices and it is easy. That's one of the reasons. It's on a laptop. And I think if the guys can almost have a checklist of the things they want to prioritize in their minds and write them down and just like look at, for us, I'll watch and just let me evaluate our cutting and just kind of go through the film and watch that. Or on defense, how are, like, let's look at our, is our footwork exactly how I like it off the ball and evaluate that and try to be specific in three or four things that you're evaluating. Because essentially, in particular in practice, if there's 10 guys out there, if you're lucky, if six are doing the right thing. So you can't get lost in that. And in a game, five guys, once again, try to evaluate what's important to you and look at the film in that way. Other than that, I think you get lost just watching a movie if you don't get critical and then clip the things that you're looking at. And don't get lost. Well, this clip, I know he really cut off it sharp and he squared up nice and I love where the pass is delivered. Even though on the other side of the ball, there's poor spacing. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to try to teach one thing at a time, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. It also connects back to the development and improvement of individuals in your team as a process. You're not developing and improving everything every day. And that if you prioritize certain things, you're more likely to improve faster because you're focusing them and the learner on one or two things and not on everything every day. And I think that's a great, great, tremendous advice for coaches to prioritize certain things when they watch the film and not try and write down and focus on everything. Because you know, as a coach, we could come up with 1,000 things from watching a game or a film, and that doesn't do our players any good.
So one of the things we talk about when we watch film, and then we'll go on the court, we talk about exaggerating the points that we just emphasized. And then we'll do that in every drill, essentially. The point of exaggerating, slowing down, catching. Like if we're saying, hey, you talked about that reverse pivot or whatever, let's really exaggerate it in this drill right now. Let's exaggerate coming through the pass. And I think that's a good teaching tool for young kids to say, like just don't do it 100% the exact way you want it, but try to exaggerate all the teaching points that you just did, get the kids. So eventually they understand what that feels like. I think that will help youth coaches.
No, this is what I talk about is there has to be a deliberate attempt by the learner to try the things that you're teaching them to do. And it's no good if you teach it, say you teach a hard skill and then you put them in a game situation and they never try that hard skill you taught them. And that's what I love the way you phrase that, which is exaggerating, that they have to exaggerate it. And, you know, another term for that is constraints, that you create a constraint where they have to use that technique. So that's awesome. And coach, I mean, this is tremendous. I think anyone that's listening to this can tell what a connected teacher you are to how deeply you've thought about these things, and just wonderful, wonderful sharing. And I know already that I'll have pages of notes from this one, and other coaches will as well. So thank you so much for taking the time and being a part of this.
Great. I listened, I have about a 45-minute ride in. I think over the last 2 weeks when you decided to have me on there, and I'm very appreciative that you did. I listened to a majority of them, and they're really well done. I think you asked the right questions. You dive into points that, as I listen, man, I hope he goes it back. I hope he hits that one again. And you do. And I think all of us coaches appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Coach. And yeah, I look forward to further conversations with you and with other coaches as well that I know you'll help me connect with as well to have a really deep basketball conversation. Coach, great. We wish you all the best. Have a great year.
Thanks, Chris. Take care.
To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.